there and welcome to this very special edition of GUcast, joining once again with our friends from the Prostate Cancer Foundation to bring you another global webinar. Today we are focusing on one of our favourite topics, PSMA theranostics. We've covered this in great detail on GUcast over the past 18 months or so, and today it's a great pleasure to focus on the recent landmark VISION trial published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Professors Michael Hoffman and Declan Murphy host a special event, along with Dr. Howard Soll and Dr. Andrea Miyahira from the Prostate Cancer Foundation, and featuring senior investigators from the VISION trial. More than 700 registrants from 62 countries joined us today, and we're really pleased to bring you this podcast of the full webinar. Here it is, and please enjoy.
Well, good morning, everybody from Melbourne. This is Declan Murphy, a urologist at Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre in Melbourne, joined here by my co-host, Professor Michael Hoffman, nuclear medicine physician here in Melbourne as well. And it's a great privilege for us to open another PCF Prostate Global Webinar focusing on PSMA, and this morning focusing on the extremely exciting area of PSMA theranostics. We've covered this before, Michael, haven't we? But it certainly deserves a revisit, well, for a number of different reasons, but particularly today following the publication of the VISION study, and that's going to be the focus of the webinar today. And before I hand over to Michael and we'll introduce the panelists and do some other formal thank yous, I want to play for you a little clip. And this is a clip that I think will charge you up and help you, if you're not already excited enough about theranostics, feel even more excited about it. So this is the voice of one of our eminent speakers today, Dr. Oliver Sartor, when he was speaking on the Theragnostics webcast recently. Take a listen to Oliver.
It's going to rule the world. You watch. It's going to come early. It's going to come often. It's going to go to other diseases. This is the theranostic breakthrough we've all been waiting for. It's going to change the way we treat cancer.
Well, he's like some sort of a revolutionary, Michael, isn't
Thanks,
he?
Thanks, Oliver. You sound like a nuclear medicine physician.
He is. He's doing the work for you. But there you go. And that's a fabulous podcast, by the way. We should plug our friends at Theragnostics from San Nordica. They do a great podcast on Theragnostics, and we'll put the link in the show notes. We're also recording this, as ever. It will be posted as a YouTube feed later, and it will also be posted as an episode of GUcast, which is the podcast that we run here from Peter Mac. Michael, over to you.
Thanks, Declan. So we've got a number of guests. We'll introduce them as we go along rather than all at once. We also have some consumers online. So just be aware, we're not giving any specific medical advice during this meeting. So I'd like to start by introducing Dr. Howard Soll. Howard coordinates the global academic government and biopharmaceutical sector research activity for the PCF as the Executive Vice President and Chief Scientific Officer. And Oliver and PCF have really been involved in PSMA for 20 years or so now. So I wonder if you can give us a bit of a snapshot of what's happened over that time and where we are in 2021.
Well, thank you, Michael and Declan. And Dr. Sartor, thank you for that inspiring dialogue to kick us off. I'm joined by my scientific partner, Dr. Andrea Miyahira. And the foundation has been involved in funding prostate cancer research and PSMA science since 1993. So it's, you could ask, why has it taken so long? Well, it's been done with extreme care and responsibility. And now we're at a point where it's really affecting patients, where we know the safety and efficacy of one of the treatments. Michael asked me to comment on where I see the field going from here, and it's a timely question since Andrea and I are actually preparing a review article for the Journal of Nuclear Medicine on the role PCF has had in the development of PSMA theranostics. And it's pretty extensive. We're still cutting down the word count, but it's a lot of material. The VISION trial is a peg in the ground. It's a milestone, and it's really a terrific set of findings that we will continue learning about for months and years, actually years to come. But we see the future of this field expanding, as Dr. Sardar said, into other cancers, because PSMA is not restricted just to prostatic epithelium. We know its distribution in humans quite accurately. And even more so for prostate cancer, combination trials, investigations in different disease states of prostate cancer is going to make this this drug more and more effective over time. So we're pleased to be here today. Thank you for everything that you guys are doing in Melbourne. It's great to have Chicago and New York and Louisiana represented from the United States, and look forward to meeting you, Dr. Lee, and learning more about what you're doing in your area. So thank you very much for another great webinar.
Thanks, Howard. I'd also like to introduce your co-host, Dr. Andrea Miyahira, also from PCF, who's Director of Research for the Prostate Cancer Foundation. We have a lot of interactions with Andrea. Andrea, are you able to introduce Oliver for us? And then, Oliver, are you able to share your slides on your side, if you like?
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get kicking. Now, if people have questions as they're going, there is a Q&A button on the bottom of your Zoom. You should type some questions in, and we'll have some interactive questions as well. Perhaps over to Andrea.
Thank you, Michael and Declan. So I'm happy to introduce Dr. Sartor. He's a medical oncologist and an internationally recognized expert in prostate cancer. He is medical director at Tulane Cancer Center and also the CE and Bernadine Laborde Professor of Cancer Research at Tulane University. Dr. Sartor has published over 400 peer-reviewed publications and has over 25,000 citations. Very impressive. Dr. Sartor has been the principal or co-principal investigator on multiple national and international advanced prostate cancer clinical trials, including VISION, as well as several other that were pivotal for FDA approval, including samarium-153, EDTMP, cabazitaxel, and radium-223. Thank you, Dr. Sartor.
Great. You made me blush a little bit with that introduction on the theranostics. So I didn't realize my enthusiasm was bubbling over.
It was fantastic.
I just had you made me laugh. Thank you, Andrea. Thank you, Howard. And thank you to the PCF for being remarkably supportive as we go forward. I'm going to take just a few minutes and talk about some of the design considerations vision, and then we'll have other presentations. You know, so this is really just kind of an overview going back to the very, very beginning. And, you know, what I'll say is that if I can get this slide advanced, is really what we wanted to do here was to design a pivotal trial for global regulatory approval and ensure that the label was suitable for implementation in multiple geographic settings. We wanted to do a global significant trial, and we wanted to influence the standard of care by ensuring that regulators recognize the importance of this therapy. It started out, and a lot of people not necessarily recognizing this, that overall survival was the endpoint from the very start. Overall survival in an intent to treat analysis is what we wanted to do. And the things got a little bit mucked up, I think, in the commercial considerations, because RPFS was added later with the FDA approval. And what it did is create a lot of short-term value for the sponsor, but it actually created a lot of uncertainty at multiple levels and led to the scan necessity, by the way, different than some of the other trials that might have been run, say the radium trial, where scans were just dispensed with and overall survival was the endpoint. The other thing we wanted to do was to be able to hit overall survival by targeting populations that had few alternatives. You know, we didn't want to come into a space where people could get X, Y, Z, or the lutetium. We wanted to target the population that really didn't have a lot of alternatives to be convincing in demonstrating the OS endpoint, and then, of course, be able to move it forward. And that's sort of the last bullet part that we point here. We wanted to create a precedent, a paradigm that we can move forward, similar to Cougar 301 and Cougar 302, and then Latitude for abiraterone. Yeah, we want to start sort of at the end and then move it up. And that's exactly what we're doing, by the way. We also wanted to keep the PSMA selection very simple and very real world. FDG PET is not reimbursed in the U.S. I admire what Michael has done with the utilization of FDG PET as a biomarker embedded into the therapy trial and others,
but not being reimbursed would have created huge issues for the label. We were thinking ahead to the label, not necessarily in terms of optimizing the actual patient selection. So one of the things that is sort of served as a template is going back to the radium days. This is the radium trial. Chris Parker and I were the co-PIs and helped to design the trial. There's some important elements in here. So first of all, we wanted to use an image-based biomarker for patient selection. Well, guess what? We did that with radium. It was called a bone scan. It wasn't the PSMA PET. It was a bone scan. We wanted to exclude the patients with non-targetable lesions. Well, it turns out that in the radium, because it's bone-targeted, if they had visceral lesions, we didn't want them. If they had big lymph nodes, we didn't want them. So what we did with the PSMA trial was to exclude the patients with CAT scan or MRI measurable nodes that were more than 2.5 centimeters and which were PSMA negative. If you had a visceral lesion more than 1 centimeter that was PSMA negative, we didn't want you. So we used the image-based biomarker for patient selection and then excluded the non-targetable lesions. We wanted the OS endpoint. And again, the RPFS was uncertain for a whole variety of reasons. And in Alsimca, we just said no RPFS. Here, the RPFS got put in later, but really for more commercial considerations. We wanted standard of care plus or minus an experimental agent. Well, guess what? That's exactly what happened in the Alsimca trial. Standard of care plus or minus experimental agent gives physicians the opportunity to manipulate things as they go along. Chemotherapy was not allowed as a standard of care. That would have been a problem with relationship to Alsimca, and it would have been a problem with relationship to this particular group. So for patients who are unfit or unwilling, they didn't go on the trial. So we took a lot of these concepts forward, and with the VISION trial, we had this loose PSMA selection criteria. We wanted a broad inclusion. We wanted a broader market opportunity, understanding that the therapy may be less efficacious because we're selecting the patients less rigorously than, say, in the therapy trial and in other trials. We made no attempt to optimize PSMA selection criteria. That was purposeful. Could we have done better and had a higher response rate? I think so. That wasn't the goal. We wanted a big, broad label. We really had a lot of questions about PSMA lutetium on bone scan progression. And that's why we chose the OS endpoint. Again, the RPFS got added later, and it was a little bit complicated. Chemotherapy was a potential active comparative to the control group. However, we weren't really sure what chemotherapy was going to do on survival. And by the way, when we designed it, we did not have the CARD trial. We just knew that we got to be a little bit concerned. But one of the things we did was allow 2 lines of prior taxane chemotherapy. So there is no third line therapy. So by allowing the first 2 lines to proceed as inclusion criteria, we felt better about excluding chemotherapy in the control arm. It turns out that about 40% of the patients had cabazitaxel and docetaxel. So this was really would have been a third line of chemotherapy, and that's not suitable. Another thing really, really, really important, if you look globally, very few patients get 2 lines of chemotherapy, and virtually no patients get 3 lines of chemotherapy when you look at a statistical basis. Look at the real-world evidence that we've garnered. People like Dan George and I have published real-world evidence. Most of the people, and this will be shocking to some, most of the people never get docetaxel before they die in the world. Most patients with prostate cancer never receive chemotherapy before they die. So what we did was put on 2 prior lines of chemotherapy as a possibility, take away the problem of additional chemotherapy in the control arm, and only patients unsuitable or refusing additional chemotherapy picked up from the Alsimca trial were allowed on the trial, and that is most men. The vast majority of men never get 2 lines of chemotherapy in the world. Now, one of the things that I think is incredibly cool about this form of therapy is we understand the heterogeneity of the disease. We understand how complex prostate cancer is. We understand DNA repair pathways. We understand PTEN loss. But the cool thing is radiation can kill them all, even with heterogeneity, even when you don't necessarily have every cell being PSMA positive. You can still kill these cells. We're going to radiate the microenvironment. and about 0.3 millimeters around the area of deposition. So that's all I have to say. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. That goes into some of the rationale about how we designed the vision trial.
Thanks, Oliver. Maybe if you can unshare your screen, that'll be great. That was a great intro. We do have some questions coming through, so everyone post your questions. I will let people know that we had over 700 people register from 62 countries, which was a pretty incredible effort. So it just highlights the global interest in this area. Here's a world map of all the people who have registered. So it's pretty phenomenal, 62 countries, almost like the Olympic Games. And here's a breakdown of the people registered, and you can see most are from the USA. Australia coming in second, despite the early hour of our morning. And here's a breakdown of the specialties where people are affiliated with. So quite a wide range there. So now I'm going to hand back to Andrea, who's going to introduce our next speaker, Mike Morris, who's going to really present the vision results.
Thank you, Michael. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Michael Morris, who is the Clinical Director of the Genitourinary Medical Oncology Service and Prostate Cancer Section Head in the Division of Solid Tumor Oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Dr. Morris is one of the leaders of the Prostate Cancer Clinical Trials Consortium, or the PCCTC, which I must point out that PCF actually started as CAPCURE back in the early 90s. He's also chair of the Genitourinary Committee of the Alliance Clinical Trials on Oncology Cooperative Group, which facilitates new testing of new drugs nationwide. And he's also one of the co-PIs of the VISION trial. So thank you, Dr. Morris. Dr. Morris, you're muted.
The tyranny of mute.
There we go.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Andrea, for the introduction, and Howard and the rest of the PCF community for sponsoring this excellent session, and Declan, Michael, and the other folks at the Peter Mac for hosting us this. It's really a great time for theranostics, and I probably can't mount the enthusiasm that Oliver can on a daily basis, but his words express certainly what many of us feel. See, so we can't express that more eloquently. So we're just gonna take a deep dive into the vision data for the next 10 to 15 minutes. So just building off what Oliver so well and eloquently introduced, the screening population here was 1,179 patients. And I think that the most important piece of information and a very good topic for later discussion is how many patients the PSMA scan actually did or did not screen out. As you can see, 87% of the patients were rendered eligible by the PSMA scan, 13%. Were rendered ineligible, which left around 831 patients to be randomized to the trial. And these are the demographics of the study. And I think that the main point here is that the treatment arms of the two endpoints, the RPFS endpoint and the OS endpoint, were quite well balanced in terms of race, their performance status, and their site of disease. The other thing that bears pointing out on this table is that about 10% of the patients had lung metastases, and 12 to 13% of these patients had liver metastases. These are important just because visceral metastases generally are a negative prognostic feature, and especially the liver metastases of the two. Half the patients had nodal disease, and like most prostate cancer patients, most of them had bone metastases. You'll see that the numbers are slightly different for the RPFS analysis set versus OS, and this is a result of the early stoppage of the trial because of a high dropout rate initially for patients who were accrued to the control arm, then a reset. And so the RPFS analysis data set is based on a slightly smaller treatment group than the OS population is. This is a table that I've pulled out of the New England Journal paper, just again reiterating what Oliver just eloquently said, and that is that all of these patients had to have progressed on at least one AR pathway inhibitor, and if, as you can see, 40% had had two. And then in terms of chemotherapy exposure, everyone had to have progressed on one taxane, and as Oliver just stated, just under half of the patients received both Cabazi and Dosi, and really then had no known life-prolonging chemotherapeutic options going into the trial. Here's the sort of so-called money slide. This is the overall survival benefit. So the hazard ratio was 0.62 with a p-value of 0.001. So this was in favor of the PSMA-617 and standard of care arm, rendering a 38% decrease in the risk of death while on study. And then the median survival was improved from 11.3 months to 15.3 months. Here's the alternative. Here's the forest plot for that. And as you can see, as I described earlier, the folks with the liver metastases did somewhat more poorly than everybody else in terms of a stratum. This is consistent with almost every other prostate cancer trial. We did have some underrepresented groups, namely the African-American or Black population, the Asian population, and you can see that their confidence intervals were quite wide because of their small representation on the study. Here's the alternate primary endpoint, which was radiographic progression-free survival, and it Vision demonstrated that the addition of lutetium to the standard of care reduced the risk of radiographic progression or death by 60%, yielding a hazard ratio of 0.4, a p-value of 0.001, and improved median time to RPFS by 5 months, from 3.4 to 8.7 months as medians for the standard of care arm and the lutetium plus standard of care arm, respectively. The forest plot generally indicates that all the subgroups that, we pre-specified as strat factors benefited in terms of receiving lutetium, with the exception of the readout on the underrepresented racial groups, as I just discussed. And then also the therapy, the lutetium, appeared to significantly improve time to first symptomatic skeletal event by, again, around 6 months, with a reduction in time to SSE by 50% with a hazard ratio of 0.5 and a p-value of less than 0.001. Now, moving on from the primary endpoints to secondary endpoints, although the SSE was a key secondary endpoint, but looking at response, this is the radiographic response for the subset of patients who had RECIST-evaluable disease. So that was 184 patients who received lutetium and 64 who received the standard of care alone. We had a just under 10% complete response rate for these patients in favor of lutetium versus a 0% CR rate for the standard of care alone, and a 42% PR response rate for those who received lutetium versus 3% of those who received the standard of care alone. So disease response and control was markedly better if you received the lutetium in addition to the standard of care. A lot more progressors, as you can see, on the standard of care arm alone versus those who received the lutetium plus the standard of care. And the same trend is seen in terms of biochemical response, of 46% PSA 50 response rate versus 7.1% in favor of receiving lutetium. And the same can be said for the cutoffs of PSA greater than 80% as well. It's important to recognize, again, in light of the discussion around the standard of care, as well as just thinking about any confounders that might yield themselves in favor of the lutetium apart from the treatment effect. So as you can see, pretty well balanced in terms of patients' post-protocol exposure to taxanes, as well as platinum-based therapy, as well as radiopharmaceuticals. But I should say that more patients, of course, received radiopharmaceuticals in favor of the standard of care arm than they did in favor of the lutetium arm. And most of that was radium, and we're just talking about 5% of the patients here. In terms of post-exposure, post-treatment, post-protocol treatment exposure to cabazitaxel, which would be the primary chemotherapy that would be in play after the treatment with lutetium was done, we're looking at less than 20% of the patients who received cabazitaxel on either arm, with 19% of having them received cabazi on the standard of care alone versus 15% on the lutetium standard of care arm. Now, this is a complicated table from in just terms of toxicity. So let's break this out into specific toxicities or adverse events of interest. So xerostomia, which is one of the key concerns in terms of exposure to any radioligand therapy that's PSMA-directed, because these small molecules do target PSMA expression in the salivary glands. Xerostomia was seen at a 40% rate for all-grade toxicity, a very low high-grade tox rate of one patient in the standard in terms of the standard care arm. No high-grade xerostomia was seen in the lutetium-treated patients. So all of this was low-grade, and the same readout basically as the therapy study and Mike's single arm phase two. If you look then at GI toxicity, 35% of the patients had all grade nausea, 1.3% of which was high grade. Vomiting occurred in less than 20%. This is generally speaking an infusion related early event, also known from previous trials, no new signal here as well. Constipation and diarrhea in about 20% of the patients to round out the rest of the GI toxicity. In terms of significant hematologic toxicity, 13% high-grade anemia, 8% high-grade thrombocytopenia was seen as a result of treatment with the lutetium. And then it should be mentioned that we did have a grade 5 adverse event rate of 3.6%. In terms of the standard of care arm alone, there was a 2.9% grade 5 rate. Of the few patients that did have grade 5 events, there was about 5 patients. Most of those are attributed to marrow failure in the post-treatment setting. And then finally, for interruption or discontinuation of treatment, we're talking about 10 to 15% lutetium-induced either discontinuation or interruption of treatment as a result of adverse events. So with that, I think I'll conclude. Just thank the entire study team for Vision for a very productive collaboration and generating a huge amount of really important data. With that, I will conclude.
So thank you so much, Mike. Well, there we have it. Two fantastic opening presentations to set the scene with Vision, with this very exciting data we've just had from Vision. And before we open it up to our panelists and to you all listening around the world with some fantastic questions already coming in, we want to invite Dr. Alicia Morgans to do a little bit of a reflection on Vision and also on the therapy study, which, of course, we already featured in a PCF Prostate webinar a few months ago, the randomized trial from here in Australia, led by my co-host, Professor Michael Hoffman. So Alicia has kindly offered to provide some reflections on what lutetium PSMA means in the landscape. She is a medical oncologist working still at Northwestern, but not for much longer, I believe, Alicia, because you're moving to Dana-Farber next month, which is very exciting, and you'll be badly missed at Northwestern, but everyone will look forward to having you at Dana-Farber. Lovely to welcome you to this webinar.
Thank you so much. And I actually am having some computer difficulties. So if there's any way for Michael or Declan to share those slides that I sent over, I would appreciate it. I will be able to just thank you. And just to let everyone know, I'm just going to comment on these two studies and really think about the quality of life considerations. As we're hopefully getting that up, I just want to remind everybody that quality of life.
Refer to the slides.
from a patient perspective is really, thank you so much, is really a combination of the adverse events that patients experience and the patient-reported outcomes that they report without a physician's interference in that, as well as this X factor, which is really the other things that patients think about, the limitations they may have, the barriers they may experience. So what are the adverse events and the quality of life and other quality considerations that we need to consider from therapy and from vision. So from an adverse event perspective, and thank you again to the host for putting this up, I think it's important for us to really recognize that generally from the vision perspective, as well as from therapy, and we're looking at vision right now, there were relatively few adverse events that met criteria for grade 3 or greater. Importantly, however, from a patient perspective, from a clinician's perspective, there were certainly some marrow effects that we definitely need to think about. And many times patients who entered vision, as well as those who entered therapy, of course, were heavily pretreated, so may have marrow conditions that already exist from the prior therapies that they've experienced or from infiltration of their marrow with the prostate cancer itself. And you can see these highlighted here. Let's go to the next slide, please. Dry mouth, as we've heard, has been something that has been noted. Interestingly, in vision, this was not really meeting criteria for grade 3 very often. And even in terms of grade less than grade 3, this was not especially common. It was less common than in therapy. And here we can see the adverse events that are listed that really caused patients to stop getting therapy. And this was also relatively low. And adverse events that led to death, also very low and similar between the lutetium arm and the standard of care arm. And here we see therapy adverse events. Again, dry mouth is probably one of the most common here, but we do see some thrombocytopenia as well as some anemia as well. Next slide, please. And importantly, therapy provided us some patient-reported outcome information, so another component of what is quality of life for our patients. And we can see, interestingly, in this comparison between cabazitaxel and lutetium, actually lutetium was favored across the board, even in things like social functioning, which I think is really a difficult construct to affect with our therapies when we're talking about advanced prostate cancer, something that we should, I think, continue to investigate and understand how patients really felt like they were able to connect more commonly socially as compared to chemotherapy, as well as, of course, things like diarrhea and other common symptoms. Next slide, please. But I want to take a minute, too, for us to take a thought about how patients themselves are feeling about this and really address the X factors, that other component of quality of life that we as a field need to continue to think about. Patients express to me, and I'm sure expressing to others, this feeling of excitement, hope, but also urgency. And we're seeing some of this in the commentary that is coming into the question and answers. There's also a lack of immediate availability and uncertainty from patients and their loved ones in my conversations about when this treatment will become available. And some have defined it as sort of a roller coaster of emotions. Patients are actually traveling and taking some medical risks to receive lutetium and doing anything they can to have access. And the underserved communities that we all are looking out for are at high risk of continuing to fall behind unless we as a field make it a priority to ensure access to everyone. Next slide, please. So just as we wrap up, important patient considerations, we've heard a little bit about PSMA PETs as well as FDG PETs and accessibility really being key. I think we need to remind ourselves that unless PSMA PETs are widely available in the US and around the world, if that is a requirement for treatment, that may also be a barrier that we have to consider in terms of geographic limitations and financial barriers, as well as lutetium itself being potentially available or unavailable. So really we have to think about all of this and the other adverse events as we think about quality care delivery for our patients. Next slide, please. So multiple factors to consider from a tolerability and quality of life perspective, but those adverse events that we've seen do seem similar between the two studies and manageable. Considerations related to access may be more critical now than symptom management considerations, as it's really incumbent upon us all to ensure equitable distribution of care and that is a priority to ensure that gaps do not widen between our patient populations. So this is my thought on quality of care. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Alicia. That's a nice segue to another aspect of this treatment, which is how it's going to be delivered. Clearly, there are some access issues at the moment, and this is going to vary around the world considerably. So I'd like to introduce one of our other panellists, Associate Professor Ziting Li. Ziting is a colleague in Melbourne who works at the Austin Hospital, where she is Deputy Director of the Nuclear Medicine Department. And she's also the Vice President of the AANMS. That's our Australian Association of Nuclear Medicine Specialists. And one of the things we've been working on in Australia is a white paper on credentialing is probably not the right word, but what sort of training is going to be required to deliver lutetium PSMA, specifically from a nuclear medicine perspective, and this is an Australian perspective, because we do recognise that it is a new technology, and anytime we implement a new technology, there's a lot of things to learn, and we need to interact as part of a multidisciplinary team. So, Ziting, can I ask you, you know, what do you think you need to have done in order to be delivering this therapy as a nuclear medicine doctor?
Thank you very much, Michael, for that introduction. And really, firstly, I'd like to thank... can you all hear me? Yep. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great, thanks. And firstly, I'd like to thank Michael and the team, really, for the invitation to be part of this deep dive into one of the landmark trials which would be shaping the future of nuclear medicine. And with due respect to all my colleagues, I'm not shy to actually say that as nuclear medicine specialists, we are the experts in theranostics, having done this for over 80 years in the thyroid space. But of course, this is expanded over the decades, and obviously, with the more recent landmark papers in the New England Journal for PRT in neuroendocrine tumors and now in metastatic prostate cancer as well, and also in the Lancet, of course, for our Australian-based therapy trial, which I believe Michael might be talking about later. But as Dr. Sartor actually said earlier, you know, this concept is not limited to prostate cancer or PSMA alone. So, and as you can see from the attendance and the interest around this treatment, the AANMS, as an association of nuclear medicine specialists, we actually thought that it would be important to set some standards for the safe delivery of this kind of treatment to patients. So we assembled a group of experts around Australia, including our expert scientists from the ANZSNM, to establish this white paper on the practice of theranostics in Australia. Now, this is a publicly available document on the AANMS website, which I believe Michael has tweeted on as well. And it does emphasize the importance of a multidisciplinary approach to the practice of theranostics, both from the clinician perspective prior to treatment and also from the delivery perspective, ensuring that relevant specialists, such as medical and radiation oncologists or endocrinologists, are working together with nuclear medicine specialists to provide this best treatment for the right patient at the right time. And we're also in this paper, we've also made sure that the environment and nuclear medicine settings are important for the benefit of our patients. And therefore, this document actually covers a whole range of issues that need to be taken into consideration so that best practice is being employed. Not only does it cover appropriate patient selection and the multidisciplinary approach to the treatment plan and patient management, but also touches upon the importance of dosimetry and imaging and the training and credentialing, both pre- and post-fellowship for theranostic nuclear medicine specialists. It's important, of course, to provide some guidelines for the administration and laboratory requirements, including standard operating procedures and qualified personnel in the laboratory, and also radiation safety precautions that are relevant to each jurisdiction that you need to take into account. But really, I guess it's encompassing all the aspects that are important in order to deliver theranostics safely. With that, I think I'll hand back to Michael. And if there are any more specific questions about that, we can touch on that later as well. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Ziting. That's absolutely fantastic. So this is one of the controversial areas I know we want to get into, who should be delivering this, credentialing standards and all that sort of business. But Michael, you've got some great questions coming in as well. Let's hand to you.
There are lots of questions coming in, so I thought we better do have some interaction. Alan Barley is a consumer advocate. We thought we might throw to him live to ask his question. Alan, are you able to activate your camera and ask your question?
Sure thing, Michael. Thank you for the opportunity. The question I have is that I've been wondering what the expected outcome or expected proportion of advanced BCA patients that show little or no PSMA expression on a gallium PSMA PET scan, and what proportion of those people might be detectable as a positive FDG or perhaps 18F pile scan?
Yeah, that's a great question, Alan. So this relates to when we screen patients, which we do with the PSMA PET scan. That was done in the vision trial and the therapy trial. What percentage of patients are suitable? And I might throw to our other panel member, James Buteau, who's a nuclear medicine physician with us at Peter Mac, one of our research fellows who's from Canada. He's been learning some Australian slang over the last year. He might share some of that with you to answer that question. And while you're answering, James, I might get one of your slides up as well, but fire away.
Thanks for having me. So yeah, I've been a bit lost in translation for the last two years, but slowly getting there. It's a great question. I think that we have the luck of having baseline PSMA and FDG imaging, so we do have a really good insight of the heterogeneity of these patients. I'd say approximately two-thirds of our patients are eligible. So you can see here, I've basically divided into four different categories. So patients with low PSMA uptake, so the bottom right, so that crikey-mate zone, the red one, essentially those wouldn't be eligible. It's about 10 to 15% of patients that we screen. Just next to it, the dodgy-mate zone in yellow, essentially you do have some high PSMA uptake, but you do have sites of discordance, so low PSMA uptake and high FDG uptake. That, again, is about 10 to 15% in both categories to the top. So no worries, mate. She'll be all right, mate. Those are very good zones to be in, so you can proceed with treatment. To the left is probably the sweet zone where you don't have any aggressive, highly FDG-avid disease. And right next to it, you have concordant disease, so it's still okay to, you have the green light to go.
Oh, well, look, this is one of the great controversial areas about this. And this is where vision has really made everyone, because in Australia, we've done a lot of this very selective imaging, FDG and PET, excluding patients. And Michael, I think about up to one third of patients in the Australian trials, therapy and the other trials we've run have been excluded. The MCRPC patients due to discordant imaging or lack of PSMA expression. But in vision, of course, nobody got an FDG PET. And when you just routinely did PSMA PET, we see that 87% of patients have a positive PET scan, PSMA scan. Now, of course, we know many more of those would have some discordance based on our experience. But I think that's one of the really important questions for the panel to help advise us on is do we need to be doing FDG PET? I keep provoking my colleagues around here saying, come on, look at the OS in vision. Why are we farting around with this very academic approach doing super selective? Yes, we enrich the population. Yes, we know those men will do well. But my concern as a jobbing urologist is, are we depriving some MCRPC patients of an OS by excluding them based on FDG? So, Michael, jump in, but we have our esteemed panelists might like to comment on this, because I think it's one of the most important things that's come out of vision is the provocative suggestion that let's just do a PSMA. Or even, as Mary Ellen discussed in the plenary, do you have to do a scan at all? Just offer them PSMA, lutetium PSMA without a PET scan.
Maybe we'll jump to an audience question to see what the audience says. Mark, can you share my slide? So this is a patient who had progressed after both docetaxel and enzalutamide. And on the left, you can see the PSMA PET scan, and there's a subcarinal node that's enlarged, and it's got low PSMA uptake on the MIP. It's just above the liver. It's got an SUV of 7 compared to 5 in the liver, so it is higher than liver. And then in the para-aortic area, there's another lymph node, and it's really got no PSMA uptake. And we've done an FDG, which we do in our centre, and we can see that all these lymph nodes are prostate cancer. They are FDG avid. So I'm going to, throw a question to the audience. And the question is, two questions here. How would you treat this patient with low intensity uptake in lymph nodes? Just to let you know, they've got a doubling time of 1.2 months. And the second question is, if they'd already progressed after carbazitaxel, would you consider them suitable for lutetium PSMA? So I'll give you a few seconds to have a vote.
Mm. mostly US audience, Michael?
It is, I think.
Are they vision believers or therapy believers?
Great. Oh, people are still voting. Lots of people are voting. Excellent. Well, the results are in. Here are the results. So I think the results highlight the role of, perhaps this sort of finer molecular imaging. Because if this patient had two options, carbazitaxel or lutetium PSMA, I'm just going to share the results.
Yeah.
Forgot that step. You can see most people voted for carbazitaxel here. So I think this patient would technically be maybe suitable for the vision trial. Although many vision trial patients were post-carbazitaxel, they would not have been eligible for the therapy study. So for the therapy study, you had to have an SUV max above 20, which is about double this intensity of uptake, whereas for the vision trial, we just needed an intensity above liver, which is met here because that para-aortic node is small and not considered measurable by vision criteria. But certainly here at Peter Mac, we've treated several hundred patients with lutetium PSMA therapy now, and we would direct this patient to carbazitaxel. In our experience, this patient's just not going to respond to lutetium PSMA. The uptake is just way too low, and there's a whole bunch of lymph nodes with virtually no uptake. And then the second question was, well, if they'd progressed after carbazitaxel, would you consider them for lutetium PSMA? And interestingly, the audience says 74% yes, so I guess they've got no other treatment options. Why not? Our current practice here at Peter Mac would be not to offer them treatment. We think they're not likely to respond. It becomes a bit of a futile exercise. I might share...
But hold on. Come on. So the first vote was, and say you're a patient and you've got progressive MCRPC and your choice is cabazitaxel or lutetium PSMA, and not everyone in Vision got cabazitaxel. And if I go for lutetium PSMA, I've got this OS. So Oliver, guide us on this. What do you think? I'm almost surprised that only a third of people, panelists, voted for lutetium. I thought it would be a bit higher, I must say. what do you think?
You know, I think people are swayed by the Australian study. I mean, the one that Michael had. And, we have to be, in my mind, a little more agnostic. And I don't really know for sure. Certainly the patient would have been a cabazitaxel candidate if he was post-docetaxel. And I think we would have probably enrolled him in the vision study. He would have been eligible there. How definitive are we in understanding that these patients are going to be non-responders? I don't really know. Let's go for a brief moment to Scott Tagawa's trial with the the J591 antibody with actinium-225. No PSMA selection whatsoever for advanced patients. Guess what? The majority of patients are responding. So how much weight do we put on this PSMA scan? How much weight do we put on the FDG scan? You know, I'm still waiting to learn a little bit. I don't feel like I understand the situation as well as I would like to.
Anyone else on the panel want to comment? Because I think this is the really big topic for us moving forward about that. And I presume the FDA approval will be linked to having a PSMA scan. But can the panel, anyone else on the panel, maybe Alicia or Michael, Alicia first, comment on this issue about PSMA selection alone versus FDG versus nothing at all?
Yeah, so I think it's a fantastic question. And I would agree with Oliver in that I don't think that the answer is entirely clear and that we do still have things to learn. It does make sense that this patient might be eligible for vision, but honestly, based on the therapy selection criteria and the FDG positivity in all of the other lymph nodes, if I really needed a response in this patient, I would probably go for cabazitaxel. But I do think that this is a situation where we have more to learn. And there are other details of this patient that would help make that decision, including what the patient thinks, what the patient understands, and what risks or time the patient has. So if this is a slowly progressing disease, we have a little time to try a therapy. If we don't get an immediate response, we're not going to put ourselves into a terrible situation. If we need an immediate response, though, cabazitaxel is probably the way I would go.
Thanks, Alicia. I might throw to another question from the audience. Harshad Kulkarni, who's a doctor in Bad Berka, which is really one of the innovators in this domain, the first centre in the world actually to administer lutetium PSMA was Richard Bohm's centre. And Harshad had a question. I don't know if you're able to activate your microphone and camera and ask it live, Dr. Kulkarni. Otherwise, if you can't activate your camera, I'll ask it for you.
Yeah, let's just move on, Michael.
His question was about a superscan patient. I'm just trying to find it. What would be the best option for a patient with a super scan? So that's someone with diffuse bone metastases. So these patients were actually excluded from the vision trial, but they were actually allowed in the therapy trial. I have an example. I might just throw to it. Mark, can you throw it? So this is an example of such a patient. This patient's got diffuse extensive bone metastases. We might actually ask the audience again, see if I can get my poll going.
And Michael, well, we have you on there as well. Do you want to make any comment on this?
Sure. I think it's important to recognize that we could not include patients with super scans on vision because of the RPFS endpoint. If they have a super scan, we cannot tell when the patient has met working group three criteria to meet the RPFS endpoint, because you have to be able to count for, you know, an additional two lesions. So those patients really couldn't be registered to the trial, even if we thought that there would be benefit and no harm to them. So I just want to put that out there in terms of a design issue.
Yeah, of course. So, and we accept that. I suppose, what's your clinical intuition, Michael and yourself, the two Michaels, Morris first, clinically, do you think they will benefit?
I would be worried in terms of toxicity for that patient. So, you know, the patients that I had who are marginally super scans on vision, they really did have significant marrow issues. I know that Mike's experience may be quite different from that, but I would have some concerns about marrow injury to that patient.
Michael, they were allowed in therapy.
Well, they were allowed. Here's what the pollists say, share results. So 56% think this patient could be treated. So we did treat this patient. This is someone we did treat, and I'll show you what the results looked like. We treated them with four cycles. This was actually our initial phase two Peter Mac cohort. And in fact, they had a grade one anemia at baseline, and it didn't actually get worse. And you can see the PSA decline and the response as well. So we do have experience with these patients. I think there's a variable definition of a super scan. You know, a super scan is typically a bone scan definition, and here we're talking about a PSMA PET scan. But to answer this question, I'm actually going to get a colleague, Dr. Andre Gafita from UCLA, who's previously been in Munich, and he published a multi-center collaboration, which we were part of, to try to answer this question. Over to you, Andre, and as you're talking, I'll try to get your slide up as well.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me, and it's an honor to be part of this PCF webinar. So actually, now you can move forward, Michael, to have the complete slide. Yeah, thank you. So actually, we performed an international study to answer to these questions, and the rationale was exactly what has been discussed before, is patients with a super scan or diffuse bone marrow involvement, they were excluding from vision trials. So I think that's a very valid question. What do we do with this patient? And what about the toxicity if they undergo lutetium PSMA therapy? So we included 43 patients who met the inclusion criteria of a diffuse bone marrow involvement of the so-called super scan PSMA PET at baseline. And we found that actually, unexpectedly, I would say 58% of them, they achieved a 50% PSA decline, so PSA response. Then also the median overall survival was 11.6 months, so very close to the therapy or vision trial, while we would expect a much shorter survival in these patients. And probably the most important is the safety profile. We found actually that high-grade anemia was occurred only in 22% of the patients, thrombocytopenia only in 25%, and neutropenia only in 8%. So I think we can conclude based on this study that lutetium PSMA is still an active treatment in this subpopulation at an acceptable safety profile. Of course, this is a retrospective study. So probably the next question is whether this patient should also not be included in the drug label.
Yeah.
So sorry for interrupting. A quick question. What was the platelet threshold for eligibility? Was it
120, 125, 140.
For the super scan?
Yes.
Yeah, if you pull up the slides, Michael, and we look at this maximum intensity projection images of baseline PSMA PET, we can see they had, so this was the inclusion criteria, they had a homogeneous PSMA uptake in the whole body.
Oliver's question was whether what their platelet counts were above.
To allow lutetium.
To allow it. Okay. I think our general eligibility criteria says you must have a platelet count over 100. I can't recall what was done in this study. Do you recall, Andre? Yeah.
These are the standard eligibility criteria for lutetium PSMA. Because patients were treated either under compassionate access programs or clinical trials.
Mm-hmm. Andre, could you tell us, of the 25% of patients who had the high-grade thrombocytopenia, how many of those patients did not recover their marrow afterwards?
I think three of them did not recover. But something very interesting that we noticed is actually in some patients during tumor remission period, they had an increase in the bone marrow function. And then again, with tumor progression, continue to decrease.
Yeah, and this is certainly something we see with lutetium dotatate as well. Sometimes patients with diffuse marrow metastases, if you treat the disease, the counts improve. I think you see this with, you know, chemotherapy in prostate cancer as well. Andre, you've also done a very nice study recently that I was proud to collaborate with as well on using a normogram to predict outcomes, recently published in Lancet Oncology only a couple weeks ago. Are you able to share that with us?
Sure. I will just briefly introduce. So we developed predictive models, or the so-called nomograms, to predict the outcome in patients who are receiving lutetium PSMA therapy in a patient population that was very similar to the VISION trial population. So we were thinking if we could really take advantage of this targeted nature of this treatment and enable an individualized treatment concept for this for patients who are candidates for lutetium PSMA. This was an international studies. We included 270 patients from six institutions across the world. And to disseminate the results of this research and enable the use of these predictive models on a large scale to our colleagues, to clinicians and researchers as well, we integrated the nomograms in an online tool that automatically calculates the individual patient risk. So I'm going to share my screen. And we will do a quick case example of a theoretical patient, a candidate for lutetium PSMA. The link to the tool can be found on Google or even in the publication. In the risk calculator, we tested 18 parameters at baseline, which included imaging-based parameters derived from PSMA PET, clinical parameters, laboratory test values, and also patient history. And we found 8 of them to be predictive for the outcome. And this includes information about medical history, the time since diagnosis of prostate cancer. Let's assume our patient was diagnosed 12 years ago. Also, our patient, he did receive chemotherapy previously. The baseline hemoglobin levels were 12. And then moving forward on the right side, to the PSMA PET parameters, we have the PSMA tumor burden, which included the average tumor uptake, the whole body uptake by tumor SUV mean. Let's assume our patient has an SUV mean of the total tumor burden of 12.
Yeah, we might.
The number of metastases less than 20, and then also we evaluated the tumor extent based on the MITNM classification. Let's assume our patient did have pelvic lymph node metastasis, also bone involvement, but no liver metastasis, which we know have a poor outcome. And here we go with the results, with the outcome. The nomograms or the online tool can predict the survival of the patients at 12 and 18 months after treatment initiation, and also the PSA progression-free survival at 3 months and 6 months. So whether the patient will have PSA progression at 3 months after two cycles of treatment and at 6 months.
That's fantastic. It's great research, Andre. And you can download a PDF report, and it's quite nice. Andre, I might just get you to stop sharing your screen so that we can see each other. So we're just Declan.
Yeah, that's a lovely bit of work, isn't it? Congratulations. I think it's only a very recent paper, but I think a lot of people out there listening will find that really useful. So the link is in the paper, I think you said, Andrea. We'll put a link on the GUcast podcast, and I reckon people will be flicking it up in front, and we look forward to more validation, but it's a really useful tool. Now, Michael, what have we got? About 30 minutes left. So there are a lot of questions here, and we got some great panelists already on the line. So can we get through as many of these questions as possible, rapid fire style, and we'll be throwing out to you panelists and quick answers if we can. Let's see, can we get through the audience questions?
Rapid fire. So I'll read out the questions, and panelists, you can just pick them off as you wish, but try to keep your answers brief, maybe even under 30 seconds, so we can get through a whole bunch of questions. So first question, the most upvoted at the moment, was from Dr. Amir Iravani, who's now in the US, previously a Peter Mac Fellow. Given the positive results of the VISION trial and the fact that only 20% of patients went on to have chemotherapy in the control arm, if you were to redesign VISION, would you allow chemotherapy or other oncologic treatments in the control arm? Perhaps Mike or Oliver can answer that.
Yeah, I'll say no, and here's why. Because most patients really never get chemotherapy. Let's look at the statistics in the United States. Let's look at British Columbia. I don't know Australia. Most patients do not get chemotherapy before they die. If you require that patients get chemotherapy in a control arm, you're excluding the majority of patients in the United States. We wanted to be big and broad. We didn't want to restrict our patients to just those who could tolerate an additional round of chemo. So I vote no.
Very pragmatic.
Joshua Lang, are there molecular alterations that predict response or resistance to PSMA RNT. Anyone want to take that? No, Michael one's keen. Hoffman.
Michael Hoffman.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Look, we don't know. I don't think we have identified any. Early on, there was some data suggesting that BRCA mutations were particularly sensitive to radiation. More recently, there's probably data suggesting that that's not the case. Those patients may actually do worse. But it is an unanswered question. In the therapy study, which is our Australian randomised phase 2 trial, we did collect blood on all patients, and we will be analysing those. So that analysis has not been done yet. Mike, were any translational biospecimens taken in the VISION trial?
No, we do not have genomic specimens, whether those are germline or from or somatic, available for analysis. So that it, recognizing that's a lost opportunity, I think that unfortunately we won't get that answer from VISION.
We certainly have some imaging biomarkers. James Buteau, do you want to mention imaging biomarkers that predict response?
Great field. Obviously, I think it's good not to stay blinded. We can actually see quite a bit with baseline imaging, particularly FDG, where you can make the invisible visible, so you can catch those discordant lesions. Justin Fernandez had published a really great paper of the first 50 patients, and you can see that the volume of FDG was had prognostic value, so above 207 milliliters could cleanly separate. You can see the Kaplan-Meier curve to right to the left. And on PSMA, a very high uptake. So SUV mean above 10 could also clearly separate the group. So the higher the PSMA uptake, the better you get a response. So I think I envision this is the way to properly deliver theranostics in the future.
Yeah, so I think if you've got multiple treatment options like carbazitaxel or lutetium PSMA, well then if the patient's got super high PSMA uptake, you're going to go lutetium PSMA unequivocally. If there's very low uptake, I think you might go carbazitaxel. Another question from an anonymous attendee. As a patient advocate who is excited about this development, I was somewhat disappointed by Vinay Prasad's recent vitriolic condemnation. He was wrong on Carbazia's standard of care and was wrong on men in the control arm leaving early because of the trial design. Would the panel be prepared to comment?
Well, I can make a comment.
Thanks, Alicia.
Vinay is very, very, very intelligent person, but most of his commentaries on clinical trials find flaws. That's kind of his job and his shtick, is that he's trying to find flaws. And I think that's important in science, to make sure that we keep ourselves honest and we identify where we can always do better. But I don't think that I would take his review of VISION or any other trial to be the overarching community-based thought. Others may agree or disagree, but that's just my take on him.
I think that's pretty diplomatic. And we do enjoy, I enjoy listening to Vinay's podcast because he is provocative, and I think it's good to be challenging. But sometimes I think it almost sounds provocative for the sake of provocative, and sometimes the knowledge of the disease area is not quite as deep as it might be. But I do enjoy his podcast. I like the way he challenges. But great question, Mr. Anonymous or Mrs. Anonymous. Thank you.
A question from Ashwin Singh Pariha. Since, and it's again a standard of care arm, maybe we've already answered it, since a sizable number of patients went on to receive carbazitaxel after lutetium in the trial, wouldn't it have been prudent to define it as a standard of care? Do the authors feel that a significant censoring in the control arm could have been avoided by including carbazitaxel?
Yeah, I think Oliver has spoken to it already, isn't it? It's a really important topic, but I appreciate what Oliver has said about it because, and also if you ask patients, if you really ask patients about it, and what we saw in therapy was, you know, the adverse events in the cabazitaxel arm compared to the lutetium arm. If I was a patient, I'd be putting my hand up saying, I'll be having that lutetium, please, and I'll save my cabazitaxel for later. So there are other existential factors rather than just, I would like to give cabazitaxel. I think if you ask the patients and they look at the toxicity in therapy, which gives us the balance, It's a no-brainer for me as a trying to imagine myself as a patient.
Yeah, and remember, 40% of the patients had cabazitaxel. I tried to emphasize in my initial slides that cabazitaxel was not an option for at least 40% and actually a little more of the patients who had already received two taxanes. So, you know, we can go back, and this is not a post-docetaxel trial. This is after one or two taxanes. And about over 40% had two taxanes in the beginning. So it's kind of a moot point.
A question from Dr. Raman Alapur from our center to Mike Morris. His question is about 13% of patients discontinued lutetium PSMA due to adverse events in the VISION trial. That's the bottom of one of your tables. Was this due to marrow toxicity plus xerostomia, or was it due to other toxicities? Are you able to clarify?
I think the majority were marrow tox as opposed to other tox.
Thank you.
Great. Another question. Liver metastases are common in neuroendocrine carcinoma. Did you check the levels of neuroendocrine markers?
No.
I did note in the VISION trial, you know, there was a breakdown, and patients with liver metastases had good responses, as did patients without liver metastases. We've certainly noted that many patients with liver metastases have lower PSMA uptake and do worse. That's not to say that they don't benefit from lutetium PSMA. And we certainly see some patients with exquisitely high uptake in the liver metastases, and they disappear quite rapidly. Another question for Dr. Morris. Did you attempt to quantify the amount of metastatic tumor?
Great question. So that will come with the analysis of the pretreatment PSMA PETs, and certainly total tumor volume will be one of the parameters that we'll be looking for in terms of being a predictive biomarker or at least a prognostic one.
We might ask James Butto about that because you have an interest in this quantification, molecular tumor volumes, and it does give us an extra edge on what PSMA screening can do for this therapy. Have you any comments on tumor volume?
Yeah, definitely. I think for PSMA, SV mean is quite useful. The volume will be interesting to look at as well, and FDG has a very important role to play. We are looking at the predictive and prognostic biomarkers in the therapy cohort, so to better inform us how we can use that to guide treatment for LuPSMA or perhaps favor cabazitaxel in certain situations.
Here's one of your slides of how you do your quantification.
Yeah, this is actually four different patients. You can see the different categories. So bone in red, prostate, you have green in nodal, green as nodal, and visceral in blue. So it is actually not too difficult to contour. So we have some quite good tools with MIM software. We're also working on some AI, so to in our physics department with Lockie and Price, who are doing fantastic work, so to end up with some one-click solutions. So it's something that could be easily accessible.
Did you find that questions with patients with greater bone involvement were the ones that had grade 3 or higher marrow toxicity? Was this the driver, or is it not clear? Oliver or anyone else on the panel, happy to answer that?
Yeah, not clear. I mean, those analyses will follow. You know, one of the things about vision is this incredibly rich data set. But really today, it would really was about getting out the New England Journal. And now the real priority is preparing for the regulatory authorities. After the real priority, which is getting it FDA approved, getting it approved by regulators around the world, we're going to sit down and do a whole series of additional analyses, but just not enough time yet. And quite frankly, not the priority.
And on that topic of regulatory approval, Oliver, maybe you have some timelines. Have we any idea what this is going to cost? Many of us around the rest of the world are looking to see what sort of price point gets agreed on this. Is it going to be ridiculously expensive?
You know, I really don't know. I would guess in the United States it'll be ridiculously expensive. But, you know, that's up to the Novartis guys and the various regulators throughout the world. Unfortunately, in the U.S., there's very little in the way of regulation of drug prices. So it's sort of a free-for-all in the U.S., but the rest of the world is probably more reasonable.
It's a really important topic, though, isn't it? And one of the things I've enjoyed about watching the nuclear medicine industry, learning a lot about it in the past 6 or 7 years, is how you can reinvent yourselves. And we've seen that with the small molecule PSMA ligands, clever radiopharmacists in laboratories in Germany, tinkering with peptides, etc. So now we have an array of tracers. And similarly with lutetium-targeted therapy, we have PSMA INT following in the background. It hasn't been acquired, I think, by a large commercial giant. So will there be competition to balance off the fact that there will be a big label and a big price point, do you think, Oliver, in the US? Do we see competition coming into this space? It's a bit different, isn't it, the nuclear medicine industry compared to the pharma industry and how it reinvents itself?
Well, PSMA INT is already being developed in the SPLASH trial, and it's the rights have been acquired by a Canadian company, Point Biopharma. The SPLASH trial is phase 3 within the context of the metastatic CRPC pre-docetaxel, if you will, chemotherapy naive. And so there'll be competition, I think, on that front. And I think if you look across the globe, there's so many. In fact, as we could go right there in Melbourne with things like Credi, with the new copper focus, you know, there's interesting molecules out there. The alpha particles, the actiniums are coming. It's just a vast world that I think is going to be unleashed in part driven by the pivotal results and vision that gives people confidence to move forward in the space.
Michael.
A few more questions from Thomas Tevenet. Is there any lutetium PSMA lesions that differ depending on their location? You know, depending on their location? In other words, are there sites that are more difficult to treat, such as bone? Look, my experience is that if it's got high PSMA uptake, we can target it very well. But I think it's fair to say we do see perhaps better responses in lymph nodes. We also see very good responses in bone. Perhaps the most worst responses we see are in liver, but it really is quite variable. We can target all sites. That's the great thing about this treatment, unlike, let's say, radium-223, the previous theranostic, which really only targeted bone. This is the first tumour-targeting treatment. Question from Rob Ware. He's a physician who used to work at Peter Mac. Comment to start with, it should not be forgotten that OS reported in Vision are average. That is true for Kaplan-Meier curves, so some patients do much better than average and some patients don't do as good as average. So the question is, couldn't the Vision trial individual data be reanalyzed to compare OS in the group with low PSMA expression compared to the group with high PSMA expression? Is that a planned analysis?
Michael?
Absolutely. And I think that goes speaks to the biomarker issue that we were talking about. Who really responds best? Who does not respond best? And so that we can make a more rational treatment choice for an individual patient. You know, I think that what you were talking about in terms of whether to do a PSMA PET or not, it speaks to that tension for trying to figure out for an individual patient how well they're going to respond to a given therapy versus how do we assess the total patient population. But certainly we can personalize the biomarker analysis better.
Terrific.
Next question. In resource constraints facilities without access to PSMA PET but with PSMA SPECT, can we confidently use PSMA SPECT for selection prior to lutetium PSMA therapy?
Good question.
I think it's hard to believe that you would be so resource constrained that you can't access PSMA PET, but you can access lutetium PSMA therapy. You're talking about quite an expensive therapy. You also have access to PET.
It's a good question, but let's say you don't, because I know a lot of my friends in China have been using PSMA SPECT CT, and obviously you don't get the same resolution as you do with a PET camera, but I think it's a really good question, because would it help you just find out about selection criteria, that yes, there's some PSMA avid metastases and this patient's likely to benefit? I still think...
What do you think, Zeting, on that question? SPECT versus PET, would PSMA SPECT be reasonable for patient selection?
Yes, thanks for that. I actually do think that particularly in a lot of Asian countries where the PET facilities are actually not available, but SPECT is, it would be a good, basically technetium PSMA scan, SPECT scans would be a good substitute for gallium PSMA PET to guide the treatment for lutetium PSMA. And you'll be surprised the number of countries where this is the case, they can afford the lutetium PSMA treatment, but they actually don't have the PET facilities. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's like a stepping stone to no PSMA PET. Mm. I think, you know, you've got right. PSMA PET, maybe a SPECT CT. What about no PET scan at all and just go straight for your lutetium? I still think it's a lingering question, isn't it, as was proposed in the discussion at the ASCO plenary.
Question from Andrew Katsifis, who's a radio pharmacist or chemist from Sydney. How do you expect lutetium PSMA 617 uptake if there is no evidence of PSMA expression or low PSMA expression? You are adding data points to your non-responders. Look, I think there's a degree of truth there because we do have some dosimetry data and we haven't talked about dosimetry. Dr. James Buteau, do you want to comment on dosimetry? And I've put up a slide to help you.
Yep. So there was a paper that was published by John Violet. So for the 31st patients that we treated with multi-time point imaging for SPECT. So you can see to the left, this is the combined... an example of the SPECT CT that you can get, and you can have some really nice calculations of dosimetry and calculate how much absorbed dose was received. And you can see to the right, very nicely separated, you can identify those non-responders quite well. The general rule of under 10 grays to the total tumor burden can help identify those that who are not benefiting from lutetium.
Yeah, so in this analysis, if there was 10 gray or less mean dose to tumor, there were 10 non-responders and one responder. So they were all the patients with the lower intensity uptake, remembering that in Melbourne, they all had really high uptake. So even at that extent, we saw non-responders at the lower end enriched for it. But that was PSA as an endpoint, so I guess you could argue that PSA response is not the gold standard and it's survival, but I think you could throw that in. Next question, is it possible to do a subgroup analysis on different molecular lesions, P53, P10, BRCA, etc.? Well, I don't think that will be possible from the VISION trial since that wasn't done, but we'll certainly do that in the therapy trial, but we might be underpowered given it's only a 200-patient study. A comment from Prue Lamberton. Hi, Michael. Don't forget that New Zealand is listening as well.
Good, well, good morning. Very early. Oh, no, they're a bit later. They're a bit earlier.
They're a bit later.
They've already had breakfast. Morning tea time. Hello, New Zealand.
Joshua Lang, are there strategies to mitigate the long-term toxicities of PSMA radionuclide therapy, such as salivary dysfunction, especially as this therapy moves earlier in the disease course for men with many years of life ahead?
You know, I might comment a little bit about that. You know, it turns out that PSMA 617 is successful, but it's not the only PSMA binder out there. And there's purposeful extension of the half-life of some of the albumin binders that seem to retain the uptake in the tumor without having the same uptake in salivary or renal. So one way might be able to do it, these albumin binders that have a prolonged half-life and less salivary uptake. Another thing is, let's not forget about the monoclonals. Monoclonals have not been at the forefront, but they really don't affect the salivary glands very much. And so with a larger molecule, you can avoid salivaries. to take 617 earlier, I think you probably will have the salivary toxicity. But I think if you have these kind of effects with hazard ratios of 0.6 or thereabouts for overall survival earlier in the stages, our RPFS effects that are 0.4, as this vision trial showed, quite frankly, I think people are going to tolerate the dry mouth.
Yeah, I think it's very rare for a patient to stop treatment because of dry mouth. I think it's probably overrated as a toxicity. Most men, it's really mild. It's something we ask the patient, do you have dry mouth? And they say, yes. Is it bothering you? No. And even in the patients where it is bothering them, they still want to continue treatment. I can hardly remember a patient whose dry mouth was severe enough that they said, please stop.
Terrific. 10 minutes to go, Michael. How many more questions can you get through?
Oh, we can keep going. Andrew Katsifis, another question. When you have limited supplies of lutetium PSMA 617, don't you have to be selective and choose patients wisely?
Generally in life, that's a good principle, but yeah, practical aspects.
I think it does depend on availability, and as it becomes more available, like all treatments, it'll become, you know, used as a standard of care more routinely. But to start with, if it's not funded and in jurisdictions where patients have to pay for it, I think it is good to choose wisely, and we are certainly keen on a choose wisely approach. Should we do another case or continue going through questions?
Oh, Declan? We need questions. We got.
Oh, you want questions?
Yeah.
Michael, can I ask you a quick question? It's Alicia. So it's sort of along the lines of the question that was just asked, and I just wonder if you and the team in Melbourne have any suggestions to the rest of us as we try to scale or anticipate scaling, you know, of course, doing the imaging, but also doing the therapeutic delivery. One of the bottlenecks that I anticipate is that we need the chairs. We need the space to actually deliver the therapy. There are many men who want to have access, and we don't necessarily have the chairs. So how do you think about rationally scaling and actually deploying this kind of a treatment?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think implementation of lutetium PSMA is, you know, a work in progress, and there's a lot of work to be done. I think probably centres that are delivering radium 223, which is quite widely available, will be well set up to transition across to lutetium PSMA 617. It is a, you know, can be delivered as an outpatient therapy. Being a beta emitter, there potentially are a few more radiation protection precautions than radium 223. Radium you can really give and discharge the patient immediately. With lutetium, there may be a short stay in the department waiting for the first urination. There are some more difficulties in administering it. So it will be an individualized thing. It's obviously going to be a mix of nuclear medicine and also radiation oncologists administering the therapy. Look, I am a fan of administering this by people that have expertise. I think, you know, the therapy approach or the Australian approach of selecting patients with high PSMA expression without majority of sites not expressing PSMA is the way to go. Having treated several hundred patients here now, I am getting a good feel for the patients who just aren't going to get a response. And you can predict that pretty reliably on the imaging. So there's an experience thing here. And, you know, I don't think we just want to be treating absolutely everyone with a expensive treatment that has some difficulties in delivering treatment, but it's going to vary by jurisdiction. What do you think, Declan?
It's really interesting. I know before you finish, you want to give the APCCC a plug as well, but at the APCC Consensus Conference, the Advanced Prostate Cancer Conference that many of the panel are involved with, at the last meeting a year and a half ago, there was a question about the use of PSMA and FDG to select patients. And I recall the proportion of patients, we're just plugging it, the proportion of panelists who voted that patients should have both an PSMA and FDG was very high. Maybe it was like 3/4 of panelists said, yes, I think we should do both. And that was after Michael had delivered a very compelling argument. But I think that same question next year at the Lugano meeting, and there's actually a virtual meeting coming up in October, a shorter meeting. The same question, I'm really interested to see what panelists, what KOLs out there think. And my expectation is that vision is going to mean that proportional drop way off, and people will say, we don't need to do both the PSMA and an FDG. But I think that's going to be a great point counter points that'll run on for a few years, Michael.
I might show another case just because FDG is a hot topic. You know, this is a patient who was screened for the therapy study, and on the left we can see the PSMA PET, and in blue there's lesions with high uptake in bone, much greater than liver, actually SUV over 20. And then in the orangey color, there are some low lesions. And then in red are these invisible lesions that we see on the FDG PET that just cannot be seen on either CT or PSMA PET. So because there were sort of four or five red lesions for FDG positive, completely PSMA negative, this patient was ineligible for the therapy study. And they went on to have carbazitaxel, but actually about 3 weeks after this procedure developed cord compression from that enlarging cervical spine lesion. So this highlights the value of knowing about it. It's not just about are they suitable for this treatment, but it's about, you know, individualizing management. And perhaps if there was a little bit of pain at that site with the FDG positivity, you would administer some stereotactic radiotherapy to there and prevent the cord compression. You would see it in advance. If you don't know, you can't individualize therapy appropriately. So not just about patient selection, but really individualizing therapy. It is important to know where the disease is. And in our experience, and I'm quite sure about this, these red lesions, the FDG positive ones, are the ones that are growing most quickly. They're the most aggressive lesions. So they're the ones that are invisible, but the most important.
Terrific. Couple of minutes to go. How much more can we get through?
What do you think about adding ENZA to increase PSMA expression in men with low PSMA expression? A question from Fadi Kiresh.
Adding ENZA.
I could jump in. I'd have to underline, I think, Louise Emmett's trial and ENZA-P, to keep a close eye on. But yes, I think there's a very important role to play, and she's designed a trial that's advancing quite nicely.
So that's a progressive MCRPC, enzalutamide versus enzalutamide plus lutetium.
Yep.
ENZA-P, yep,
recruiting. Yeah, exactly. So it could have a role in upregulating and optimizing the delivery of radiation to those.
As ever, a trial will always give us the best answer, and that's another nice trial running
and
here.
And just the slide of all the trials we have open in Australia. So we have quite an array of trials open using lutetium PSMA 617, all the way from sort of last line, all the way to a first line trial where Declan's giving a dose or two of lutetium prior to prostatectomy. So we don't have time to run through these today, but these are all, you know, centres running at around 10 sites around Australia, many of these trials. And there's a several US trials sponsored by Novartis that aren't on this slide that are up and running as well. So there's going to be a huge amount of evidence base. And the Australian studies are largely academic investigator-initiated trials. Just a shout-out to Movember and PCFA and also ANZUP and PCF. These are, you know, without all these funders, we really wouldn't be able to do this trial. And all these funders jumped in really early, 5 years ago, and allowed us to do these trials. So a big shout-out to you all, and thank you.
We are almost out of time, Michael. So I don't know whether you're going to stay on the line, but I'm conscious I have to leave and many others will as well. What do you think about staying on or having panelists answer by text? Maybe we could do that, but I'm conscious we do need
or
to
by Twitter. We'll
it.
Have to wind up in 2 minutes. One more question.
One more question, and then we'll go back to Howard.
Any comments on F-18 versus gallium 68? Well, I think they're both FDA approved at the moment, and I think they're bioequivalent, and you can probably swap them. So DCF-PYL in particular, I think, is equivalent to gallium 68. Even the SUVs are similar. I think you can take the vision data and the therapy data and swap it across.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Wow, it could have gone for hours more, Howard, but we do have to call a halt eventually. What a fantastic topic. Thanks again to you for all your support in this area and for promoting this type of education. You know, COVID has taught us a lot, but these types of webinars are incredibly valuable. I must say, sitting here for the past 90 minutes listening to all these smart folk and all these fantastic questions is very stimulating, and I can't really think of a better environment to do it in. Over to you.
Yeah, I totally agree. Thanks to all the panelists. The great questions and the global interest in the topic is actually quite overwhelming from where it first came. So thank you, Skip Heston. I saw your name show up, the scientist who first cloned PSMA.
Mm-hmm.
Vander, I'm sure you're on the call. You know, thank you for the first antibody to PSMA that was so well characterized and is still the gold standard antibody. And Michael Hoffman, Declan Murphy, and the great center in Melbourne, Michael Morris, Alicia Morgans, Oliver Sartor, and everybody else that contributed today. This is really the first step in a new journey for patients. And as a foundation, we are extremely pleased. I am personally excited and look forward to the next breakthrough.
Well, thanks very much, Howard, and thanks especially to our team here at the PCF-funded Prostate Cancer Imaging and Theranostic Center of Excellence, especially Annette van der Hayden, our project manager, who's here beside us, and Mark Scalzo, who's been running all the technical side today for us, for putting this on. This will be hosted as a posted as a YouTube video later today, and also as a GU Cast podcast. We'll push it out on the various Twitter feeds later. Michael, I'll hand over to you to finish up.
No, thanks, everyone. Apologies we couldn't get to everyone's questions and answers. We might try to continue discussion on Twitter for some of those, or email them around.
Thank you very much, and have a good day, everybody.